You know that incredibly specific, deeply unsettling feeling you get when you are driving somewhere completely unfamiliar,
Oh, yeah.
and you are entirely reliant on your phone's GPS. Like you are just blindly following the blue line.
Right.
And then suddenly, out of nowhere, you lose your cellular signal.
The worst. The screen just freezes.
Exactly. The screen freezes, the blue line stops moving, and you are left just staring out the windshield at the physical road signs.
And you get that spike in your heart rate.
Yes, you become hyper aware that you have absolutely no idea how to navigate the actual world around you.
Because you haven't been navigating at all.
Right, you've just been obeying a glowing line on a piece of glass.
Yeah.
That fundamental human muscle of orientation, of reading the landscape and making deductive choices,
Yeah.
has just completely atrophied.
You're just sitting there wondering, how do I actually get home?
I want you, the listener, to hold on to that exact feeling of sudden, helpless disorientation. Because today, we are taking that feeling and applying it to our own minds.
We are looking at what happens when that exact same atrophy hits our capacity for critical thought.
Exactly. Now, if you were with us for the first part of this deep dive series, The Devotion Economy, Fandom, Identity, and the Machinery of Attachment, you'll remember we broke down how the K-pop industry essentially industrialized the psychology of attachment.
Right, we looked at how massive corporations engineered human devotion into this incredibly efficient revenue model.
And what that revealed about the underlying truths of modern fandom. We basically established that the machinery of devotion has been perfected.
It's running flawlessly.
But today, we are flipping the lens. We are asking, what is happening to the audience sitting on the receiving end of that machinery?
Because there is a profound, almost tragic irony at play here.
Yeah, let's unpack that.
Well, at the exact historical moment the entertainment industry perfected this devotion economy, the intellectual infrastructure that used to build our capacity to actually process media has been quietly dismantled.
It's just falling apart.
Right. We have built an unprecedented machine for generating obsession, aimed at a population that is rapidly losing the cognitive tools required to handle it safely.
To explore how this happened and what it looks like on the ground, we are using a truly remarkable essay as our guiding text for this deep dive.
It's such a good piece.
It really is. It's called The Opinion Industrial Complex: Fan Culture, Identity, and the Erosion of Critical Thought by Darling Nisi.
And Nisi lays out a central thesis that is going to serve as the spine of our entire conversation today.
So, what is that thesis?
Basically, that we are witnessing a systemic collapse of our critical thinking infrastructure. And this collapse has spawned a culture where people form their opinions based almost entirely on other people's opinions.
Right.
They perform outrage as a substitute for actual identity. And perhaps most bizarrely, they confidently deliver absolute moral verdicts on texts and games they haven't even read.
If we borrow your earlier analogy, the machinery of modern fandom is a high-speed train hurtling down the tracks. But Nisi's argument suggests we are looking at a scenario where the passengers have entirely forgotten how to read the map.
Or even look out the window.
Exactly. So out of sheer, unarticulated confusion and panic, they just start attacking whoever happens to be sitting next to them in the passenger car.
That brings us to Nisi's opening observation, and it's a stark one.
It really hits you.
If you look back at how online arguments used to function, particularly in fan spaces, the fights were vicious, but they were almost always fundamentally about what a text meant.
You were arguing over interpretation or theme or authorial intent.
Right, but today, if you step into those same spaces, the argument has shifted entirely. It is now about whether you are allowed to engage with the text at all.
Nisi argues these communities have morphed into moral tribunals.
Where the quote-unquote crime being prosecuted is simply the act of consuming the wrong content.
To truly grasp the magnitude of that shift, we really have to rewind. We have to look at the cultural landscape of the 1990s and early 2000s that Nisi meticulously details in the essay.
Because the internet was young then, and engaging in niche hobbies like hardcore anime fandom or early PC gaming carried a significant amount of built-in social friction.
Identifying as a fan of those mediums inherently made you an outsider to mainstream culture.
And within those outsider spaces, particularly those dominated by female fans, there was a deeply embedded contract.
Which was simply that fiction is fiction.
Exactly. Consuming dark, complex, or taboo media was not viewed as a moral endorsement of those acts in physical reality.
It was almost the opposite, wasn't it?
Yeah, Nisi points out that engaging with incredibly dark themes was understood as a safe, contained sandbox.
A place to explore feelings of powerlessness or a lack of real-world control.
Look at early anime fandom in the West. Shows like Serial Experiments Lane, which was drenched in existential dread and themes of suicide.
Or Kite, which is basically an explicit grooming and revenge narrative.
Right, those were consumed and discussed without this modern compulsion to wrap everything in massive disclaimers or defensive posturing.
Nisi uses this brilliant historical example, the anime web Turnpike.
Oh, the Turnpike. It is a perfect artifact of this era.
For those who weren't surfing the web in 1997, the anime web Turnpike was essentially a massive directory that organized the entire anime internet before search engines were truly useful.
And on there, everything from innocent fan art to cosplay tutorials to explicit hentai was listed completely neutrally side by side.
It was a purely descriptive directory. There was zero moral pathology attached to what link you clicked on.
The site didn't judge you. It just said, here is the content categorized by what it materially is.
So the operative question Nisi asks is why that non-judgmental environment was able to exist and function in the first place.
The essay argues that those early spaces relied on a shared baseline of analytical skill among the users.
And that specific cognitive skill, the ability to separate fantasy from reality, the ability to analyze a text objectively, was being actively built by two parallel pipelines in society.
Both of which have since collapsed.
Right, so let's talk about the first pipeline, which is the traditional classroom.
This is where Nisi's argument moves from internet history to structural critique. The educational model used to demand that students sit with ambiguity.
You were handed a difficult piece of literature, and you had to synthesize incomplete information.
You had to identify themes and build a defensible argument using the text itself.
You couldn't just throw your hands up and say, the protagonist did a bad thing, therefore this book is bad.
No, you had to explain why the author made that choice based on the evidence on the page. But that pipeline is fundamentally broken now.
And we aren't just speculating here. As a study from Pursuit by the University of Melbourne confirms, almost half of college students now show no significant gains in critical thinking or complex reasoning over a four-year degree.
Think about the downstream effects of that failure.
It's massive.
A massive portion of the population is exiting higher education without the cognitive tools to navigate complex, ambiguous arguments.
But the classroom is only half the equation, right?
Exactly. The second pipeline Nisi identifies is our leisure media.
At the exact same time the educational system was shifting away from teaching synthesis, our entertainment was systematically removing the cognitive friction required to engage with it.
This might be my favorite observation in the entire essay.
Same here.
Think about the mechanics of playing a video game in the early 90s. If you booted up The Secret of Monkey Island or one of the early Ultima games, there was absolutely no golden path to follow.
The game did not hold your hand.
You were dropped into a hostile or confusing world and forced to figure it out. You had to synthesize incomplete clues from dialogue.
You had to talk to random non-player characters.
And literally get out a piece of graphing paper and draw your own maps just to figure out where the next town was.
Progress required deductive reasoning. You had to exercise your brain just to move forward.
But look at a modern AAA game today. The contrast is staggering.
Modern games literally paint a glowing, pulsating path on the ground for you to follow.
They put a massive arrow on your minimap, pointing exactly to the next objective.
The mechanic has become the metaphor for our entire cultural moment.
The cognitive offloading is total. The game is doing the intellectual labor for you.
It navigates so you don't have to experience the friction, the frustration, or the ambiguity of being lost.
Which brings us right back to the GPS analogy we opened with.
Exactly. We didn't suffer some sudden evolutionary drop in intelligence. We just completely stopped exercising our navigational muscles.
Both physically and intellectually.
We've become so deeply conditioned by the GPS, the algorithmic feed, the glowing waypoint telling us exactly where to turn and what to think.
That the moment a piece of media hands us a blank map and asks us to interpret it ourselves, we panic.
We just completely freeze up.
And because we no longer have the critical framework to navigate that ambiguity, we default to the easiest possible response.
Moral outrage.
Yes. We label the ambiguous media problematic and demand its removal. Not because it is actually causing real-world harm, but because it is causing us cognitive distress.
We are misinterpreting our own lack of reading comprehension as a moral failing of the text.
It is a fascinating way to frame it.
But it's not just about how our brains are changing. Nisi emphasizes that it's equally about where we're taking those brains to have conversations.
Right, because if the critical thinking muscle has atrophied, we have to look at the arenas where these arguments actually take place.
The architecture of fandom spaces has undergone a radical evolution,
shifting from an era of containment to an era of what sociologists call context collapse.
Let's trace that evolution. DC starts with the Usenet era, IRC channels, and the very early message boards.
And it is vital to note that Nisi is not romanticizing these spaces. They were not utopian.
Not at all.
They were incredibly abrasive and often highly toxic. But the nature of that toxicity is the key distinction.
The hostility was argumentative, not verdictive.
Exactly.
Hold on. For listeners who might not have spent 2002 deep in the trenches of a forum, what exactly does that distinction look like in practice?
Well, it means that if you wanted to attack someone's position on a message board, you had to bring your evidence. You had to have your receipts.
You had to quote the specific chapter of the manga, or cite the exact timestamp of the episode, and logically construct a counterargument.
You could be incredibly rude while doing it, but you still had to engage with the primary text.
And that specific ecosystem was maintained by a very powerful natural filter, which was friction.
Technical friction, first of all, just figuring out how to configure a Usenet client or connect to an IRC server required a baseline level of computer literacy.
It acted like a bouncer at the door.
But beyond that, Nisi points to a much more important social friction community accountability.
If you logged onto a forum and made a completely baseless bad faith argument just to stir up drama, the same 100 people were going to be in that forum the next day.
And the next week? Your reputation mattered.
The community was a closed loop, so you couldn't just drop a hand grenade of an opinion and sprint away into the ether.
But then the architecture of the internet fundamentally changed, and the walls of those closed loops came down.
Nisi points to the rise of Tumblr in the mid to late 2000s as the major inflection point.
Because Tumblr centralized fandom.
Suddenly, you didn't have to seek out a specific isolated forum for a sci-fi show and a completely different website for a video game. Everyone was in the same building.
And drastically different audiences with drastically different community norms and varying levels of media literacy were suddenly rubbing shoulders.
And the crucial mechanical shift Tumblr introduced was the reblog.
Content was designed to travel across community lines by default.
You could write a highly nuanced 2,000-word analysis of a really dark, disturbing theme in a horror game, intended for an audience of fellow horror fans who understood the context.
But someone could reblog that post, and suddenly it's sitting on the dashboard of a teenager whose entire online experience revolves around pastel aesthetics and wholesome cartoons.
The context is instantly violently stripped away.
That is context collapse in action. The nuance dies the moment the text crosses the community border.
And then Twitter, which we now call X, arrived and accelerated this dynamic to its absolute weaponized extreme.
Think about the structural impact of the quote tweet and the ratio mechanics.
When you quote tweet someone, you aren't engaging in a conversation with them.
No, you are dragging their words out of their localized context and holding them up for your followers to judge.
I always think of it like this. Imagine you're having a really heated, incredibly nerdy, hyper-specific debate with a friend in your local pub.
Okay.
Everyone sitting around you in the pub knows you both. They know your history. They know the inside jokes. They understand the context of the argument.
Right.
Now imagine a trapdoor opens, and that exact pub argument is teleported onto the 50-yard line of the Super Bowl halftime show.
Oh, wow.
Broadcast to 100 million people, and the crowd is essentially handed a button to execute the loser.
Of course, all nuance evaporates.
You are no longer debating a peer to find the truth. You are performing for a Coliseum crowd to ensure your own survival. It's a gladiatorial arena.
And into this algorithmic coliseum, an environment inherently lacking context, nuance, and accountability, arrived the ultimate systemic shock.
The events of 2020.
The pandemic.
Nisi argues we simply cannot overstate how deeply the COVID-19 lockdowns rewired the social dynamics of the internet.
You suddenly had this massive, unprecedented influx of new users pouring into these centralized spaces.
People were physically isolated in their homes, completely severed from in-person social feedback loops.
And the absence of that physical feedback is critical. When you are sitting alone in a room, typing anger into a screen, you don't see the micro-expressions on the other person's face.
You don't see them wince when you say something overly cruel.
You don't experience the real-world friction of a physical disagreement that naturally modulates human behavior.
And it wasn't just a behavioral shift, it was a cognitive one. We have to be clear-eyed about the psychological state of the audience that flooded the internet during that period.
Nisi highlights that we are talking about a population undergoing measurable, generalized cognitive decline.
As research highlighted by EdSource confirms, the pandemic caused significant declines in verbal reasoning, flexible thinking, and memory across students of all ages.
And this decline was compounding an already existing downward trend.
Right, because a publication from the PUIRP notes that a generalized over-reliance on technological shortcuts has led to a 10 to 15% drop in deductive reasoning and inference making in the general population over the past 30 years.
Let's sit with the implications of that collision for a second.
Yeah,
you have millions of people who are physically isolated, starved for social connection, and suffering from a documented measurable decline in their ability to reason flexibly or make complex inferences.
And they are pouring into algorithmic platforms that are explicitly engineered to reward outrage, strip away context, and gamify social validation.
That specific intersection of conditions is the exact recipe for what Nisi coins the opinion industrial complex.
In practice, what does the opinion industrial complex actually look like?
It means that the very act of arguing online has been severed from the pursuit of truth or understanding. It is now entirely an exercise in identity performance.
A user enters an echo chamber.
The platform's algorithm, designed to maximize engagement, feeds their confirmation bias.
The user quickly learns what the dominant in-group believes about a certain piece of media.
They adopt that conclusion as a badge of membership, and only retroactively, if at all, do they search for out-of-context quotes or summaries to support the stance they've already taken.
The moral verdict precedes the evidence.
Always.
And Nisi points out that this dynamic manifests most aggressively in the rise of purity policing within fandoms.
This is the intensely puritanical strain of modern fan culture that operates on the rigid assumption that consuming dark, flawed, or problematic fiction is a direct one-to-one signal of a person's real-world desires or political morality.
If you read a story about a villain, you must secretly harbor villainous intent.
Nisi draws a fascinating and honestly brilliant structural parallel here between incel culture and purity culture, what some spaces refer to as femcel culture.
It's a provocative comparison because, ideologically, those two groups present themselves as complete polar opposites.
Right. On the surface, they seem diametrically opposed. Incels are typically associated with deeply misogynistic, right-wing extremism, while purity policing and fandom often cloaks itself in the language of progressive social justice.
But Nisi strips away the aesthetics and looks at the underlying mechanics.
Incel culture is fundamentally obsessed with policing women's real-world behavior, autonomy, and bodily choices.
Purity culture, conversely, is obsessed with policing women's fictional fantasy lives.
They scour fan fiction archives and art sites to hunt down women exploring taboo themes, demanding they repent or face public destruction.
Both movements are born from chronically online populations who are deeply alienated and lacking in real-world social friction.
And both groups share a core psychological delusion.
Which is?
They view the private choices of strangers, even choices made entirely within the realm of fiction, as a direct existential threat to their own identity.
This is a profound misplacement of moral anxiety.
And crucially, as Nisi points out, it is entirely disconnected from actual real-world harm reduction.
As the Prostasia Foundation confirms, hunting down and harassing creators over taboo fiction under the guise of child protection is a misguided moral panic that completely ignores actual primary prevention.
If it's not actually protecting anyone, if it's doing zero material good in the real world, why is the drive to do it so powerful?
I look at this behavior and I can't help but wonder if this performative outrage is actually just a desperate, twisted form of self-soothing.
That makes a lot of sense.
If you are a young person living through the 2020s, you are likely feeling completely powerless.
Yeah.
You can't control a terrifying global pandemic. You can't fix a collapsing housing market. You can't halt climate change.
But what can you control?
You can control whether someone on the internet is allowed to draw a fictional character kissing another fictional character.
You can organize a harassment campaign to force an artist to delete their account.
It provides a tiny, concentrated hit of righteous power in a world where you otherwise feel entirely impotent. It's faux activism acting as a security blanket.
That is a highly legible way to understand the psychological incentive at play.
But theory can only take us so far. Nisi understands that to truly prove this thesis, we need to examine how the systemic failure of critical thought plays out on a specific, highly traceable text.
We need a case study.
And the essay provides a culminating example that perfectly illustrates every single layer of the opinion industrial complex we've discussed.
Let's get into the case study, because this is where the abstract theory hits the concrete reality of internet culture.
We are looking at a mobile game called Love in Deep Space.
And specifically, the massive controversy surrounding a character named Caleb.
To do this justice, we have to lay out the actual primary text of the game's lore. Because Nisi's entire point is that the controversy only existed because the audience actively refused to read the text in front of them.
So let's look at the narrative architecture the developers built.
Caleb and the MC, the main character, whose perspective the player inhabits, are orphans.
They were subjected to horrific medical experiments as children by a shadowy organization called Eviar.
They are eventually rescued and raised by a scientist named Josephine, who pulled them out of the lab. They affectionately call her grandmother.
But the crucial load-bearing element of their shared history, the mechanism that generates the narrative tension, is the specific nature of those childhood experiments.
Right. The MC possesses a unique physiological anomaly. Her heart contains a core that allows her to be brought back from death.
And during their time in the laboratory, she dies violently. Repeatedly.
We aren't talking about near-death experiences. Nisi points out the text implies she dies dozens of times.
Dozens of times in agonizing ways. And the horror of the situation is asymmetrical.
How so?
Caleb remembers every single death. He retains his memories. But the MC's memory is repeatedly wiped as a side effect of the resurrection process.
Oh, wow.
So Caleb is trapped in an inescapable cycle of psychological torture. He has to watch the person he loves die violently, often calling out his name, completely unable to stop it.
And when she is brought back to life, her mind is a blank slate.
She doesn't remember him. She doesn't remember the bond they form. She doesn't remember the trauma.
He has to continually reintroduce himself over and over again to a girl who just died begging for his help.
The emotional gravity of that backstory is immense. It is a suffocating, dark, tragic foundation for a character.
Now, fast forward to the present day in the game, where they are adults. Caleb exhibits some very specific interpersonal behaviors.
He is obsessively protective of the MC.
He is constantly monitoring her safety. He is deeply possessive of his role in her life. He pushes other people away.
How does the English-speaking segment of the fandom react to this deeply traumatized man?
They instantly slap the label Abusive Yonder on him and call it a day.
For clarity, Yonder is a Japanese anime trope referring to a character whose romantic love transforms into violent, controlling obsession.
Right. And by applying that flat, prepackaged anime trope to Caleb, the Western fandom completely ignores the actual text of the game.
They reduce him to a one-dimensional, problematic archetype.
Which represents a profound failure of reading comprehension, exactly as Nisi outlined.
If you evaluate Caleb's adult behavior through the lens of the primary text, his obsessive protectiveness is not some arbitrary toxic character flaw inserted for shock value.
It is the highly legible, psychologically accurate output of profound, prolonged childhood trauma.
It is the textbook trauma response of a man who has carried an impossible, isolating weight for his entire life.
But the English-speaking fandom ignores this because fundamentally, they are not reading the primary text.
They are reading other people's summaries of the text on Twitter or TikTok, and those algorithms have already flattened the character to fit a specific, easily digestible narrative of outrage.
But wait, I have to stop you there, because aren't we letting the developers off the hook a bit?
How do you mean?
Nisi's essay points out that Infold, the developer of the game, actually made this problem exponentially worse through their localization choices.
Ah, yes. This is what Nisi calls the localization trap.
If you look at the non-English versions of the game, the original Chinese, the Japanese, the Korean texts, the relationship between Caleb and the MC leans incredibly heavily into a forbidden quasi-sibling dynamic.
The MC uses terms like Jeej or Opa when speaking to him.
Those terms are critical.
They're honorifics, translating roughly to older brother, and they carry a deep familial intimacy even when the characters aren't strictly blood relatives.
In Eastern media, this pseudo-incest trope is incredibly common and culturally legible.
It is the very engine that gives the romance its narrative weight and tension.
The tragedy of Caleb and the MC is that they are bound together by an impossibly close shared trauma. They were forced to act as family to survive, but they harbor romantic feelings that cross a societal taboo.
That friction is the point of the story.
Exactly. The friction is the story. But the English localization team took one look at that dynamic and seemingly panicked.
They anticipated the exact kind of context-collapsed, purity-policing backlash we just talked about.
They tried to preempt the Western audience's outrage. So in the English text, they scrubbed the familial terminology.
They completely sanded down the edges and cleanly labeled Caleb a childhood friend.
As noted on TV Tropes, this is a textbook example of a Woolseyism, altering a translation specifically to avoid cultural misunderstandings or values dissonance from a Western audience that generally reacts with immediate revulsion to pseudo-incest tropes.
But look at the narrative damage that localization choice caused.
By changing him to a childhood friend, they completely strip the story of its cosmological and emotional load-bearing tension.
A childhood friend who acts that obsessive and possessive is just weird and creepy.
But an adoptive brother who was forced to watch you die 50 times in a laboratory and who is now desperately trying to keep you safe while fighting his own taboo romantic feelings? I mean, that is a Greek tragedy.
By sanding down the edges, the English localization broke their own story logic.
And more importantly, they set a massive trap for the English player base.
Because the truth of the original Chinese text was eventually going to break through. You can't hide the core premise of your own game forever.
And the truth did break through, spectacularly, in early 2026.
This is where the outrage mechanism of the opinion industrial complex goes into overdrive.
Infold released an anniversary card titled Throne of Eros, and shortly after, they released the highly anticipated third myth storyline for Caleb, titled Ghost's Final March.
And in these specific releases, the localization team finally stopped hiding the ball.
They dropped the act. They explicitly used brother and sister terminology in the English text.
The characters are literally calling each other baby sister and big brother in a highly intimate, undeniably romantic context.
And the third myth goes even further into the cosmological lore. It explicitly references the Chinese creation myth of Fuxi and Nua.
For those unfamiliar, Fuxi and Nua are sibling deities in Chinese mythology who repopulated the earth. They are often depicted with intertwined serpent bodies.
The text of the game literally refers to Caleb and the MC as two flowers from the same stem. They are cosmologically intertwined siblings.
The fallout from this revelation was immediate, chaotic, and entirely predictable if you understand the mechanisms Nisi has outlined.
The English players were incensed.
They flooded social media, claiming that Infold was betraying established canon, that the developers were suddenly and maliciously introducing biological incest into a story where it had never previously existed.
But as Nisi thoroughly documents, this outrage is factually baseless.
The dynamic was always there in the source material. It was present in every other language version of the game from day one.
The outrage was a pure, unadulterated manifestation of the echo chamber.
The moral verdict, this is a betrayal, this is disgusting, this must be purged, was decided upon the moment the terms brother and sister appeared.
And then the fans furiously defended that predetermined conclusion without ever actually looking at the original lore.
Without bothering to understand the cultural significance of the Fuxi and Nua reference, without ever looking at the original Chinese text.
The intermediary, the flawed English localization and the reductive Twitter summaries had entirely, completely replaced the primary text in the audience's minds.
And this brings us to what might be the most deeply ironic and tragic layer of the entire Caleb controversy.
The absolute erasure of the female protagonist's agency by the very people who are claiming to protect her.
Within the narrative of the game, the MC is not a blank slate. She possesses interiority, she has a defined history, and she makes active, enthusiastic choices to stay with Caleb.
She initiates physical contact, she pursues the relationship.
But the players, completely lacking the critical distance required to separate themselves from a fictional avatar, treat her as a blank self-insert vessel.
Which gives them the psychological permission to completely override her in-game agency.
They project their own real-world anxieties onto her. They say, well, I wouldn't want a possessive adoptive brother, therefore she shouldn't want this.
They systematically erase her actual written character, her trauma, and her desires, all under the guise of protecting her from Caleb's supposed toxicity.
It's mind-boggling. They are enacting the exact kind of controlling behavior they are accusing the fictional male character of exhibiting.
But I have to push back again on the developer's culpability here.
Okay.
Because if Infold localized the game and called him a childhood friend, they essentially lied to the English audience for years.
That's true.
They built a terrifying haunted house, slapped a coat of bright pink paint on the outside, explicitly told the Western audience it was a bouncy castle, and then acted shocked when people walked inside and started screaming at the ghosts.
That is a great analogy.
But on the flip side, looking at how the fans reacted to the Fuchsia Nua lore, it completely validates Nisi's central thesis, doesn't it?
Yes, it really does.
The audience didn't have the reading comprehension or the critical thinking skills to realize they were standing in a haunted house to begin with. The context clues were all there in the horrific trauma backstory, in the possessive behavior, but no one had the intellectual muscle to read the map.
That is the exact tragedy of the situation. The developer's cowardice and low vocalization met the audience's illiteracy in reading comprehension, resulting in a perfect storm of context collapse.
But what makes Nisi's essay so vital and deeply concerning is that this inability to read the text in front of us has implications that reach far, far beyond the confines of a mobile gacha game.
This brings us to the ultimate and frankly chilling conclusion of the essay.
Because the cognitive offloading we've been tracking for the past hour is about to encounter its final, most powerful, and most destructive form.
The rise of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
If we trace the historical trajectory we've laid out, we happily offloaded our physical navigation to the GPS. We offloaded our mathematical calculation to pocket computers.
We offloaded the friction of debate, accountability, and argument to social media algorithms.
And now, Nisi argues, we are poised to offload critical thinking itself to generative AI.
This is the part of the essay that actually kept me up at night, because AI is the ultimate frictionless offloading tool.
If you have a population that is already primed by the opinion industrial complex to actively avoid primary sources, a population that explicitly seeks out summaries instead of reading the text AI, is perfectly, almost demonically designed to give them exactly what they want.
You don't have to read the dense lore of a video game, or a complex 500-page novel, or an ambiguous political policy.
You just ask the AI to summarize it for you, and it will.
But it won't just summarize it. It will form the argument for you.
It will evaluate the moral weight of the text based on its own invisible algorithmic guardrails, and it will tell you exactly what position you should take that perfectly aligns with your pre-established, internet-defined identity.
We have to contextualize this threat far beyond the realm of fandom.
The love and deep space controversy over Caleb is, in the grand scheme of human events, incredibly low stakes.
It's a localized panic over the fictional relationship dynamics of anime-styled avatars.
But the exact same mechanism, the loss of deductive reasoning, the reliance on intermediary summaries, the outrage driven by identity performance rather than factual analysis, shapes how citizens process breaking news.
It shapes how voters evaluate complex political claims.
It dictates how we decide what is objectively true in the real world.
Fandom, in this context, is simply the canary in the coal mine. It is providing us with a real-time, highly visible demonstration of exactly how a population with diminished cognitive infrastructure behaves when confronted with complex, ambiguous information.
Which leaves you, the listener, with a truly provocative and honestly terrifying final thought to mull over as we wrap up this deep dive.
If our capacity for critical thought continues to measurably decline, and we increasingly rely on generative algorithms to digest our media, to flatten our nuances, to form our opinions, and to fight our online battles for us.
Are we rapidly approaching a future where artificial intelligence is literally the only entity left in the room that has actually bothered to read the primary text?
It is a profound and unsettling question.
Because if one AI summarizes the book, and another AI writes a moral critique of that summary, and we simply adopt the emotional posture of the critique without ever opening the cover,
then who is actually participating in the fandom? Who is participating in the culture? Is it us?
Or are we just watching the machines read to each other?
While we sit in the dark on that high-speed train, staring at a blank map, completely forgetting how to drive.